that I think the current system in Britain is about the best I've ever seen for auditing the classifications, for having reliable data, that makes Britain the right place to do this, at least until November 22nd of this year, when elected commissioners come in and they ruin the whole thing. So until then, you can use the CHI to measure trends in crime harm within each patrol area, within each police force, across the country. You can compare cities, you can compare areas, in principle you can compare nations. But perhaps most practically, you can compare the harmfulness of offenders, and you can allocate prison space by harm forecasts. You could make a serious harm forecast a much more meaningful part of sentencing guidelines, as it is in Virginia, and as it is for parole release in Maryland and Pennsylvania, but which I think is still very crude in how it's done statistically. So here's one more example of the obvious point. I don't think I have to beat it to death in this audience. Obviously, with a count, the less serious events dominate because they're more frequent. In an index, the more serious will dominate because they might have a much higher weight. In a count system, the volume dominates, but in an index, it's the rare events that dominate. And it is the rare events that are in the news media. It's the rare events that feed people's understanding of how safe the community is. So if they don't believe the crime statistics, maybe it's because it doesn't comport with their judgment of what's serious. The problem is that if we move to the index, then we're dealing with rare events, which are, of course, harder to predict. So how do we deal with that? How do we get beyond what probation is already doing in their four tiers of low risk of harm and high risk of harm, which was described to me recently by a research manager at the National Offender Management Service. She said the way the probation people do their harm classification is to look into the offender's eyes. And as George Bush said about Mr. Putin in Russia, I looked into his soul. So they look at the criminal history, they look in his eyes, and he said, this guy's not harmful. This is, I'm afraid, the way lots of clinical decision-making occurs. And Paul Meehl in 1954 famously compared such clinical decisions to any kind of quantitatively based population analysis that led to a forecast. And 200 replications of his work have been done since then, according to the new book by Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman, who's a psychologist, who with Amos Tversky developed what's called prospect theory. The new book is called Thinking Fast and Slow. It's a review of a wide range of issues that relate to not just crime, but many other fields. But Meehl published his book just as Kahneman finished his PhD, and it had a big influence on his career because of his understanding about how people made decisions. And essentially, Meehl showed that people prefer to make decisions intuitively based on qualitative impressions, and they hate having statistical algorithms tie their hands. And they don't want to be thinking that a number can do better than human judgment. And the problem is the data are pretty clear. The formulas beat the human judgment 60% of the time and equal to it 40% of the time, and 100% of the time they're a whole lot cheaper than the highly paid psychiatrist who might spend several days with somebody who's been accused of murder, and the question is whether he's sane enough to stand trial.
Doesn't that comparison you just made depend upon the context where you're choosing between intuition and formula?
Forecasting the value of Bordeaux based on the wine expert's judgment versus the statistical algorithm.
But for instance,
parole board decisions to let people out and see whether they kill somebody. That's,
those
they
are two particular contexts.
Air pilot errors, judging which pilots are going to make mistakes. Bankers' judgments about credit risk, they're all in there.
Yeah,
and the evidence runs right across.
Supposing, for instance, I wonder whether it's going to rain, I'll look at the clouds, but I'm not going to use a computer.
Right.
That's intuitive.
Well, it's
based
also
on experience.
It's also possibly wrong. And
also possibly wrong.
And the question, Meehl is trying to answer is which is more likely to be correct. And so
the point I'm trying to make is it depends on context.
Well, that's actually the point that Kahneman and Sherman made.
The Met Office with their big computer may be able to predict whether it's about to rain on me, but I don't have that computer.
Right.
So I have to use what I have.
I'll give you that. Is that the standard by which you want to put people in prison?
It could be, because it would depend on your resources.
Would you argue that your point that you just made proves that it's better to use expensive, qualitative clinical judgments when you can use a cheap algorithm we've now gotten down to 15 seconds to compute in Philadelphia?
It will depend.
On what?
For instance, the comparison you've just made now,
right,
is that you have what you claim is a cheap and effective method, which apparently works.
I didn't say effective.
Anyway.
But I can give you its error rate, which is more than most qualitative decision makers.
But if you have that available, for instance, if my pocket calculator on my iPhone was able to tell me whether it's going to rain, I'd use it. Yeah. But I don't have access to the Met Office computer. And if you have access to this simple algorithm, which has a good effect, good effectiveness, then by all means use it.
Well, Ted, I'm sorry, with all due respect, I fail to see why that should get us away from the idea of trying to improve the basis for making critical decisions affecting people's lives.
I'm not suggesting that.
Well, what I'm trying to suggest is that we could do better than looking at the sky.
Yeah, but your early statement was that the formula beats the intuition.
That's correct. Every time you've got qualitative data and quantitative data on the same thing, you are in 200 replications either getting equal results for less money or better results.
Yeah. So if I, being me, had a cheap computer which could reliably give me the answer, I'd use it.
Right.
But since I don't have the resources to access the computer that I would need,
right,
then I have to use...
So why are you telling me this when we spend $20 billion a year on the criminal justice system? Clearly we have the resources, mm-hmm, and we're not using it. That's my point.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay, yeah, good.
No problem with that.
So let me just go on to say that this dedication to skill is not about convenience. It's about the belief that the skill is better in human judgment than it is in algorithmic forecasting. And a major cultural issue right across the justice system, including the parliament, including the news media, is the belief and the superiority of qualitative judgment over quantitative scheme, which is really what Kahneman's book is about in terms of these two systems of thinking fast and intuitively or slow in a rule-based way. And I really recommend the book to anybody who wants a very wide-ranging review of the literature and evidence on this. But I've cut out, I think, the point about the stable context, which I was dealing with in 84, and the notion of observed feedback in a stable context, I think, is critical for this debate about skill. What I found is effective in talking to police and judges, not prosecutors, they're impossible. But if we look at tennis coaches who can tell, like Rick Braden can, whether the ball is going to go over the net before it even hits, before the racket even hits the ball, he knows if it's going to get over the net. And we realize that he's actually observed whether or not the ball got over the net hundreds of thousands of times in a 40, 50 year career as a tennis coach. So his judgment's just fine. In fact, the experiments are, if you ask him to think about how he knows, he gets less accurate. He doesn't want to take it apart too much because it destroys the kind of automaticity and accuracy of it. But you suppose in a thought experiment that he could never see the net, that he would never get any feedback. Would he then have that skill? Could he have developed all of that information flowing into his brain that would give him that knowledge? And it then gets us to this question about how he compares to investors. Because Kahneman's got lots of stuff about bankers, you love it, and how they really don't do better than the chance in even in a very highly paid profession, even with very large bonuses. And one reason Kahneman suggests is that the stock market is not a stable market. It's not like a tennis ball hitting a net. That the goalposts keep changing, the rules, the dynamics, the currency exchanges, all of the characteristics of the market are too unstable to make the rules clear enough to give you the feedback. And you could say that about the stock market, but you can't say it about women playing brass instruments. And now we get away from instability and into the, one of the larger problems with qualitative predictions, which is bias. Male conductors were always convinced that women couldn't play brass until they put up a screen. And so when Sergio Celibidache heard Abby Conant play a perfect high C on the trombone, he said, "That's the most beautiful sound I've ever heard. We have to hire him." And when he found out it was a woman, he insisted that there had been a man playing that note behind the screen and that they were cheating on him. And then he refused to allow her to play, and she eventually had to sue. And finally, the law forced him to do what he would not accept was true about his supposed skill, which is that he could hear perfect music, and he would know that it would have to be a man. So much for the limitations of skill.
Didn't she just repeat playing the note for him?
Then he wouldn't believe it, because when he looked at her, it would introduce the bias into his perception. And this is part of the problem with judges looking at criminals and deciding how long to put them in prison. Also, when coaches hire football quarterbacks, they're not necessarily looking for performance, they're looking for what looks like performance. Being tall, being graceful, looking self-confident, and ignoring the statistical evidence on whether they actually score points and help to win games. And this is the plot of a recent Brad Pitt movie about evidence-based baseball using statistics on cheap baseball players to have a more cost-effective team, hiring the least expensive, highest-performing people you could, and it took the Oakland team from the bottom of the leagues to the top in one season. The best scene in this movie is where the coaches, the recruitment coaches, are sitting around cursing at this young kid from Yale with a statistics degree who is choosing these baseball players and effectively making the coaches, the recruiters, the scouts, irrelevant. And most of them walked out on the team saying, "This team is heading downhill. Without us as good scouts and recruiters, you're going to lose all your games." And of course, that prediction is false. There's even now a name for this in baseball called sabermetrics, the origin of which are obscure to me. This is not. The Pennsylvania Parole Board refused to do anything with forecasting and algorithms about harm until they let out a robber who had been charged at a very early age with robbery, I think age 12, and he immediately shot and killed Sergeant Patrick McDonald in the Philadelphia Police Department. About that time, Richard Burke and I were working on the article we've since published in the Journal of the Royal Statistical Society, looking at some 50,000 probationers in Philadelphia, the usual population. We had a training sample of 30,000 and a separate sample of another 30,000 over a several year period, which gave us something that looks like this. Something that was predicting murder or attempted murder with approximately 58% accuracy compared to a regression model that would get roughly 2% accuracy. The false positives, false negatives ratio was set in a random forests process that tells you in this graph how much error is added to the forecast if you were to take out the current age, the age of first contact, which is the second biggest factor here. It was the clearest predictor to me in looking at the record of the man who killed that police officer as soon as he came out. One of the things that may make this more predictable in the US is guns, and there's such huge availability of guns generally in America and in the United States as well. In a minute, I'm going to show you some preliminary models from the UK data, which don't get nearly as much error introduced if you remove the top factors. We have somewhat more factors. We're not getting quite the same level of accuracy, but we're getting pretty close. And for each individual variable, you see lots of nonlinear patterns. Here is the age of first adult disposition, meaning that if your first violent charge is at the age of 12, then for the rest of your life, you'll be far more likely to be charged with murder than anybody else in the population whose first serious charge is later in life. Here we have the midlife crisis crowd who comes in a big way, but they're never as bad as the people who start at age 12. This is current age in Philadelphia. This is total violent arrests. Doesn't take too long to rise and then level off. But of course, if you combine it all, what you get is a forecast of the average charges of murder. In the top 2%, we get 37 and a half charges per murder per 100 people in the top group, and five per 1,000 in the bottom group, which is 60% of the probation population. And if we then multiply
For clarity there, what are the high, neither, and low mean?
This was the group as divided by risk level.
Okay.
And once we made the division and then looked at their offending over the next 2 years, what we got was 75 times more charges for murder or attempted murder in the top 2% compared to the bottom 60%. The biggest difference then for the highest harm. If we just look at any serious offense, the difference is not nearly as great. If we look at all offenses, it's even less, but still quite substantial. But the big news is here. And again, if we take the most harmful thing seriously, it turns out that it actually makes the prediction better rather than worse, at least in the American data. And we're still just really beginning with the UK data, in which we take not whether or not you're charged with murder. We're trying to move to the number of days in prison as the response variable. And what we have so far, just in terms of whether you get into this group of robbery, rape, and other violent offenses, out of the 100,000 convicted in the year 2000, looking over the next 2 years, for each of these instant offenses, what you got convicted on, we're seeing, again, a big concentration out in the low-risk group, which I don't think the judges see. I think what the judges are always imagining, what the prosecutors are always imagining, is that they're going to wind up here. And what they don't know is just how small this group is, because they hear these big numbers about recidivism, which are being driven by larceny, shoplift, all of this minor stuff. And they're way over-predicting the serious stuff, which is, as you can see, running at about 6-7% of the sample. If you even look at the instant offense, if you ask a judge who's more likely to cause a really serious harm, a harmful violent crime over the next 2 years, is it a violent offender or a burglar? And they'll probably pick the violent offender, but you can see the burglar is actually more likely to wind up there on that list of robbery, rape, murder, serious violence. You can't just look at the number of priors, as I think judges and prosecutors are fond of doing. One Philadelphia prosecutor said to me, what can I get out of your fancy statistics that I can't get from looking at a rap sheet? Well, if you look at the number of days they were sentenced to prison in the two-year follow-up period based on the number of prior convictions they had at the time the two-year follow-up period began, you see a completely non-linear relationship. As you run out to 200, 250 prior convictions in this population, getting not many more days in prison sentenced to them over the next 2 years than the people who have fewer than 25 prior convictions. And with this funny peak in the middle, possibly by a chance distribution, look just at the custodial convictions, the number of days you're sentenced to prison, not the prior convictions you had at the time you were sentenced, but the number of prior times you've been in prison at the time you were sentenced. 120 preceding custodial convictions, custodial sentences with these people in the year 2000 for the instant offense. And then in the next 2 years, the number of days of custody that they receive. Clearly, just looking at the raw numbers, just looking at the list on the police national computer of your prior offenses or your prior custodial sentences isn't going to do it. So what we can do is to prepare this model, this 15-second calculation that we now have in Philadelphia in the probation department. So as soon as you have your identification number put into the criminal history system along with the model, the forecasting model, you don't get this, but what you do get is the high, medium, and low as a risk classifier. And this is a model that we're looking at the moment. What we're seeing here, as I mentioned, is not nearly as much error from each one of these, but with number of prior convictions still being number one, despite what we just saw, the age at first charge being number two, just as it was in Philadelphia, whether your instant charge was a robbery in 2000, whether you're a male, and so on right down across these 22 predictors. If we're looking for overall accuracy, what we're getting here is 56% classification of true positives and true negatives across the model. If, however, we wanted to focus just on getting low-risk people out of the criminal justice system, we, I think, be interested in 79% accuracy. And we can do even better in a different model that's not as accurate overall. But if our main interest is having the police be guided in deciding who not to prosecute and who to keep away from the judges so that they won't be banged in prison unnecessarily, if you want to get the prison population down at the front end, you might want to have a model that has only 17% error at the front end. Especially since some of that error, if not most of it, is going to come out over here on the moderate side. And as you can see, that's the moderate error. And the actual number of cases in which you're predicting that they're low risk or low harm and they come out to be high harm is substantially lower. So you'd be in the, if you wanted to say this person's either low or moderate, you'd be 95% accurate. That's a model that's never been available to anybody in Britain before. Or indeed at the front end anywhere in the world, as far as I know. And it allows you to make a distinction between Al Capone and the choir boys. Now, Al Capone was a very harmful character. You've heard of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Quite a few people died at Al Capone's instructions, but we couldn't prove it. So we got him for tax evasion. And he died in prison. Like to think he was less harmful in prison than when he wasn't. The point may be that you can persuade people that a way to deal with very harmful offenders is not just to prosecute them for harmful crimes, but for less serious crimes, taking their forecasted harm based on their prior criminal history into account in the way that other sentencing guidelines have done more crudely. The Virginia sentencing guidelines, for example, are all about recidivism. Either or. Either you recidivate or you don't. Just like the offender group recidivism score, the Ogres scale that's used in the UK. No harm in it at all, except whether or not you're going to have a reoffense. And here we have harm estimated in the Capone approach. You could do that with somebody who's convicted of smashing a window, but he's got enough priors that tell us he could be very seriously harmful that you could prosecute him at the top of the sentencing guidelines. And somebody else who's not very harmful, you could use a non-custodial or even a non-prosecution approach.
I'm actually slightly puzzled by the implicit suggestion here, because you're talking about prosecuting somebody for a crime different from the one he actually committed.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, I'm not.
Well,
no, I didn't mean to say that.
You just talked about prosecuting for a crime in a different sentencing guideline category.
No, I'm talking about prosecuting for a crime for which the person can be prosecuted with evidence.
Yeah.
But what tends to happen is that they look at the instant offense much more intensely than they look at any sense of how dangerous the person is by a holistic view, qualitative or quantitative. What they didn't do with Al Capone was to do that. They said, this guy's dangerous, let's get him whatever we can convict him of. I guarantee you he did evade income tax.
Yeah, sure.
And he was convicted for that substantive offense.
But I mean, the point I'm going to lead on to is that if you're going to make this kind of adjustment for risk index, that could be incorporated in sentencing guidelines for a given crime.
It could.
So that your prosecution is actually accurate with respect to the crime. And you earlier talked about police deciding not to prosecute for a crime in order to reduce the prison population.
In 2003...
Whereas you could prosecute for the crime, get your conviction, but sentencing guidelines evaluated in terms of the risk index would say not prison.
The 2003 Criminal Justice Act required every judge to assess the dangerousness of every offender and to adjust the sentence based on the dangerousness of the offender. It gave the judge zero guidance, no framework, no principle, no criterion at all to decide what is dangerous or not. Nonetheless, my own political forecast is that trying to use a quantitative model at the point of sentencing is far more controversial than using it where the police have already diverted half of all offenses given a criminal record, which is out of prosecution altogether, to simple cautions, fixed penalty notices, and other things where they may be actually giving these breaks to very dangerous people. And more importantly, if the crime itself had some unsavory characteristics, not giving those breaks to people who are actually quite low risk, many of whom are now clogging up the prisons with short-term sentences and getting heroin habits that some of us are concerned about when they get out. So what I'm trying to do is to create a different context for assessing each offender in relation to each offense, in relation to what the statute already requires, which is a consideration of future offenses. Now, the law professors hate that. They say with Kant, you can't punish people for crimes they haven't committed. They say with the viewers of a movie called Minority Report, you can't interfere with people pre-crime, or to try to stop them from a crime that they didn't know they were going to commit yet. I think there is so much emphasis now on separating the cases that will be prosecuted from those that, quote, don't need to be prosecuted, but without any framework for making that decision, that at the front end, there's reason why 12 chief constables have asked us to give this to them in their custody suite, so that when an arrest is made, no matter what for, the arrestee can be walked into a custody sergeant who can put their name in the computer and get a quantitative assessment of whether this person is highly likely to be a choir boy or an alcoholic. Irrespective of the offense, the only question they would make an answer to is, what should we do with this offense for which we have evidence? That question would be answered differently depending on where the harm level would be forecast. And if the harm level is low, it allows you to go to the most underemphasized area of deterrence, which is not severity, in favor of politicians and judges, and may not even be certainty, although you can get greater certainty if you act right away, with immediacy, in a way that I'll tell you about. But basically, it gets beyond what the prosecutors tend to do. And that is, they won't even go for any of this if they can't absolutely have an airtight case, and they'll drop it, knowing that the offenders are very likely to be guilty in many cases, and knowing that if there was some intervention of a less severe nature, there might actually be a crime prevention benefit. That's where the sort of Damocles comes in. That's where, if you use the legislation on conditional cautioning, in which people are willing to accept the fact that they've committed a crime and that they will try to make up for it in lieu of being prosecuted, and potentially having a more severe penalty, that's great in theory. What happens in practice is that their lawyers advise them not to do it. And we're trying to launch a randomized trial in Hampshire right now. We're in phase one with people who used to be getting simple cautions. The director of public prosecution said, we don't want them to get simple cautions for domestic violence. We want them to get conditional cautions for domestic violence. But you can randomly assign two different cautions. One is essentially nothing, a bindover. The other is going to 2 3-hour counseling sessions, which we think are misconceived and not likely to work. But we're happy to at least test a kind of low intrusiveness option with prior experimental evidence suggesting that might be a better way to go with not very injurious cases, very often just shouting and not even hitting. What's happened in that case is now the prosecutors are looking at every one of these and they're disallowing cases that used to be getting cautioning. So they're actually putting in less criminal sanctioning, which might be a good thing. But instead of having a randomized trial, what we're actually seeing is a kind of quasi-experiment in which the prosecution is overruling the police decision to take action in these cases, which might suggest then that the best path would be completely outside of the criminal justice system and emphasizing a strategy of voluntary restorative justice, conferencing with other family members, other ways to solve the problem besides just saying it's out of the criminal justice system, we won't have anything to do with it. Okay.
So have you in effect said that the Crown Prosecution Service makes a decision on a crime for which there is good evidence?
Yeah. Not to prosecute.
Not to prosecute.
Every day. Thousands of times.
Yeah. So it's not a question of likelihood of conviction.
It is. They have two requirements. One is that it is very likely that they'll get a conviction.
Yeah,
the other is it's in the public interest to prosecute.
Ah, right.
And the public interest to prosecute
is a vague thing.
Could depend on whether crime will go up or down as a result of the prosecution. And that decision has something to do with this meta-analysis of randomized trials in prosecuting juveniles that Anthony Petrosino has done for the Campbell collaboration, which I happen to know is based on an out-of-date effect size here, which is mine. Since updated it, we put it over here. So it might alter it. But at the moment, it's a statistically significant increase in crime to prosecute. And not prosecuting is better. So this has had no impact on judicial policy in any country, as far as I know. Even though the test is still, it has to be in the public interest to prosecute. Half the kids that they're prosecuting in juvenile court are going to young offenders institutions without, I think, any awareness that there may be I'll show you some other evidence in a minute, what is causing them to commit more crimes. What we're about to introduce with full random assignment in May in a major police force in this country is what I wanted to call Operation Damocles, but which the police who read the sociological research on how people have a turning point in their lives to get out of crime, they want to call it the turning point plan. So that basic idea is like a conditional caution, only it's simply police deferring prosecution. They don't have to admit anything. The police say, we're not going to prosecute you if you will sign an agreement to get drug treatment, to get a job, to do restorative justice, to move to another town, to do something that will turn your life around. And if you don't do that, or if you sign it but you don't do what you promised to do, we will then prosecute you. And we certainly prosecute you for any new crime in addition to the old crime. That's the sword of Damocles hanging over your head. And we're getting lots of cases of first offenders who, because we didn't have the fully operable risk model, we're assuming all first offenders no previous convictions at all. They can go up this this ladder of escalation. This is actually civil penalties or regulation of pollution in organizations. So don't pay any attention to the content. Just think about the pyramid, which is what the Project Hope is doing in Hawaii with people who keep failing their drug tests, who used to not go to prison 5, 10, or 15 times they failed the drug test, but on the 17th or 19th time, suddenly they went to prison for 2 years for failing the drug test. And they didn't know what was going on. So this judge named Stephen Alm said, why don't we have a program in which the first time they fail the drug test, they go to prison for one night. The second time they fail the drug test, they go to prison for 2 nights. The third time they fail the drug test, they go to prison for 3 nights, and so on. Mark Kleiman and Angela Hawken did a randomized controlled trial of this swiftness and certainty compared to the normal process of failing lots of drug tests and again then getting severe sentence, very long sentence. In the group that got the short sentences with high certainty and high swiftness, 50% fewer prison days, 55% fewer new crimes, and the National Institute of Justice is replicating this in multiple states. Meanwhile, the original pilot program, I got a confidential email today to tell you, it's confidential and it's being recorded, so I'm not going to tell you what it said. Never mind. But what I can say is that this is all part of what you can do with lower risk, lower harm people, even in the absence of the risk classification that I'm proposing. But I think once you have those harm forecasting tools available, there will be much more willingness to do what the police are doing in this major police department, which is agreeing to be offender managers. They've already partnered with probation at the back end when people come out of prison, but they're willing to do this at the front end if they can see that they're going to get a better return on investment for keeping people from getting into crime on a much more serious basis, including some preliminary evidence we have on restorative justice. I think the best results can come from something that has more emphasis on the emotional reaction that people and other primates have to the fellow suffering of their other primates that they've been causing, and the evidence of altruism that caused this fellow with 5,000 burglaries to suffer post-traumatic stress from his restorative justice conference with his victim and another victim. Years later, he tells me he still had nightmares remembering what the victim said to him in this 2-hour confrontation. Now, these are methods that get well beyond what you would ever get in a criminal justice system. And we are even seeing that the victims were getting reductions in post-traumatic stress symptoms. This is our systematic review, modest, but across 12 different tests, 11 of them with victims. This one had no victims, it's just drunk driving. So if you take that one out, you get an even slightly better result, but certainly a modest effect size. Very modest, very smallly modest, but consistently across the vast majority of the trials, getting reductions in repeat offending. Using this, testing this, especially with low-risk offenders with high-harm offenses, and we find it's the high-harm offenses that have had the best results. If you just look at the violent crimes, you double the effect size in the meta-analysis with five separate trials. This is what the percentage differences look like, easier to talk to practitioners about. And what we're looking at now is a whole series of randomized trials. We've already done one in Philadelphia for low crime harm index people. And we find if you have them see their probation officer twice a year, it doesn't make any difference from seeing them 4 times a year or 12 times a year. If you go into the high crime harm index people, we're giving them cognitive behavioral therapy, and it's not working all that well, I think we're going to have to work much harder to figure out what to do to try to rehabilitate the most dangerous people. And if it doesn't work, I think we have to think seriously about more prison for them. But the medium people, maybe Project Hope, reinventing community corrections around this kind of algorithm is something that's now on discussion with NOMS. And they've actually asked me to write protocols for 3 randomized controlled trials, one at each harm level, once the algorithm is put in place. So some progress is being made in making justice more statistical, more evidence-based, less qualitative and dependent on subjective judgments about how you fit round pegs in round holes and square pegs in square holes. But it goes back to the beginning of using the principle of harm to draw the shapes and to put people in the right place. Thank you very much. And if you have to run, please go ahead.
Questions, comments? Sorry.
Sheila, don't forget your jacket.
Thank you. Yes, sir. It might be a naive question, this isn't my area, but the idea of zero tolerance, is that kind of at odds with your approach? Is there any way to tally them? I don't know if there's any evidence for zero tolerance working, so it might not be a reasonable question in the first place.
There are a number of constructs that are labeled zero tolerance. One of them has to do with police enforcement on the streets. So any illegal behavior, including jaywalking, crossing the streets between the lights, or littering, or smoking marijuana, would lead to being taken into custody. So that's one understanding. Another understanding is at the prosecutorial level. For every offense that's brought in, you will seek the maximum penalty possible, or at least try to bring the offense to justice. New Labor did this. They set targets. They said it's like quotas. You have to meet. In London, there had to be 110,000 cases brought to justice with a caution, with a conviction, a conditional caution, or something. And in 1 year, it went from 110,000 to 120,000. Not because there were more offenses, but because the government said, we want you to bring more cases to justice, which is a kind of, you know, punishment machine, which David Howarth, the former MP from Cambridge, compared to bread and circuses, that we do this as entertainment for the masses, to show them in the Daily Mail that we really are bloodthirsty in our desire to wreak vengeance on evildoers. And that's why we're doing it. I've spared you the evidence on what happens when you put people in prison for the first time, but it actually triples their offending rate in a propensity score matching comparison, first done in Amsterdam, and now it's just been done in Florida with 130,000 cases, which allows you to get pretty good matches for people who are likely to go to prison, but don't, compared to the very similar people in their prior record who do. And there again, you're getting doubling or better of the offending rate for those people who are put in prison for the first time. And that lasts right up to age 25, which is most people's first time to go to prison. So this emphasis on short prison sentences, this emphasis on bringing more offenses to justice, might have been good politics, but it seems to have been very bad crime policy. And just how bad it's been, we probably won't know until we recompute all of the crime statistics for the last 10 or 20 years with a harm index, rather than just counting crime. Yes, sir.
I had a question about what would be the issues in building the algorithm for just building the algorithm, and then for, let's say, national and cross-national comparisons. One thing that I thought about when you built one or gave an example of the days spent in jail.
Yes.
How about areas with mandatory sentencing? Wouldn't that offer some distortions, for example?
Well, it's interesting. You can look at the crime harm index of a population in two ways. One is the actual sentences received, which I would argue is misleading, because it's leaving out this vast body of offenses that don't get near the judges. And there have been some cases where serious offenses actually get a caution or a fixed penalty notice. There's an index that a doctor at University of Cardiff named Jonathan Shepherd uses based on 78 accident and emergency rooms. And if you were to take that index as an annually sensitive variation in the weight assigned to the assault, whether they're actual bodily harm or grievous bodily harm, you might in your year be able to get a better grip on
the extent to which safety is increasing or decreasing in the population. I think anything that can independently take the range of weight in terms of days punishment out of the sentencing council guidelines and apply it to the reported offenses, rather than taking the people who are caught and the number of days to prison they get, has the huge advantage that when you have 4 million crimes reported, you can count all 4 million. There's more than that in the British Crime Survey, which is based on interviews of probability samples of the population. What you get with the reported crimes to the police is more detail about each offense, including the injury level. And if we actually used some money to sample those police crime reports and connected it back to the sentencing guidelines, we could have a crime harm level calculated based on the metric of the guidelines rather than on the imposed sentences for the people who got caught. And especially considering that there's less than a 1 in 4 chance that any of these crimes will have somebody assigned to them, you're going to be omitting 75% if you just look at those who are punished. So to go back to the offense report and then go right to the recommended statute, the recommended penalty for the crime report would be, I think, the best way to do that. And to do cross-national comparisons, you'd have to use the same metric. So for England to do cross-national comparisons to Sweden, you'd want to use the English metric. For Sweden to do cross-national comparisons to the rest of Scandinavia, they'd want to use the Swedish metric because the sentencing guidelines would be much less severe in the Scandinavian context than here. And there, for some offenses, they're actually more severe here than they are in the United States. But that's for comparative uses, and that's not nearly as pressing as internal year-to-year uses and variations. Is Manchester more dangerous than London? Who knows? At the moment, the categories don't tell you, but a combined weighted index. Yeah.
What role does actual sentences passed play in your harm index?
Only, I think, if we get to the level of the individual's custodial history, where you get in the sentence passed at least the subjective virtues of a judge's reaction to how much does this crime shock the conscience. And the categorical values from the sentencing guidelines reports are very insensitive to the particulars of a crime in which, you know, you can assault somebody by punching them, or you can assault somebody by stomping on their arm when they're down on the ground and you're a 72-year-old victim, or woman who is perhaps seriously injured. My mother-in-law at 86 has just had her wrist broken by a woman who drove into her in a parking lot. And so there is not going to be any criminal charge, there's not going to be any compensation. But the doctors now tell her for the rest of her life she will never recover the full use of her wrist and she will always be in pain. So, you know, the particulars of those things, when judges hear about them, affect their sentencing.
Yeah.
But they don't get into the categories.
And also behind that question was, when the harm index becomes an element in sentencing policy or in prosecution policy, then the effect of the harm index on the policy will feed back to the harm index.
It will, and the way to avoid that, if we take this seriously, I'm sure once we take it seriously, there's going to be committees pawing all over this, right? But one thing they could consider is trying to go with a more egalitarian system that would be insulated from the individual biases of different judges and would simply go with a category. If it's actual bodily harm, then here's the midpoint of days in custody for actual bodily harm. If it's grievous bodily harm, here's the midpoint. And we try to, in effect, stay away from the nuances because those would be subjectively and inconsistently coded. What can be consistently coded is within the rules for charging these different offense types, you would have a consistent midpoint of sentencing that would be applied across all people, black, white, Muslim, Christian.
So the plan is to lay down something stable in that respect?
I think stability, equality, fairness, all of those things are absolutely central, because the idea of being treated like a mere statistic is offensive and undermines legitimacy. So the problem statistics has in trying to be helpful in making justice more fair and more cost-effective is that it can be seen as immoral. So everything we can do to back away from the appearance of being inhumanly immoral and unfair and not acknowledging these nuances, I think is important to do. But it's never going to be a perfect balance. And the problem with the attack on statistics is that it's implicit that the statistics are the problem, when the real problem, I think, is the inconsistency, subjectivity, bias. Ian Chalmers, the founder of the Cochrane Collaboration for Medical Interventions, has a graph he shows of the percentage of first burglars who were sentenced to prison by magistrates area across England. And the range was 15% to 85%. So whether or not you go to prison for burglary was a lottery based on where you did it. That's what happens without any quantitative quality control. And people seem happy to live with that, because if you're in Berkshire, you don't really care what's going on in Cumbria. But if we're going to use a national statistical model based on all cases in England and Wales, we might be able to even that out.
So to follow up on that, one of your top predictors, I think, was age of first contact. And I'm worried that old bias is just going to be pushed into new bias, where if age at first contact is like the same distribution, where 15% to 85%, depending on where
yeah,
you
whether
live,
they got let go.
If
yeah,
the same
yeah
applies to age at first contact, you're just, it's just a...
Yeah, it's interesting. That variable came from Pennsylvania, where you don't get into the adult criminal justice system unless you've committed rape, robbery, or murder. So that's what it meant in Philadelphia. And that doesn't vary. If a kid is charged with rape at the age of 12, they're in one place they're likely to be charged in another place as well.
But if not,
because
but
it's
okay,
at that high
end of seriousness. But there's also, there's every other kind of bias. There's race, there's socioeconomic background.
Yeah.
And I don't think that your likelihood of first contact is the same across all of, I don't know, maybe there's evidence, but
I
wouldn't guess that it would be the same across all of those.
I think at the severe end, there's much less discretion, much less variability. Burglary is not severe enough, and that's why it's a good example for Chalmers to use. But in the English data, what you're pointing out to me is something I hadn't thought too much about yet. And you know, I literally got these data last Thursday. So thank you for helping me see that we shouldn't just use first contact, we should use age at first violent crime. And that would have less discretion.
You want to try to make it to have something of
yeah
things which have a little.
We might even push it up to the age at first murder, robbery, or grievous bodily harm or rape. Those offenses, and if they don't have those ever, then they wouldn't be in the model, and it would probably improve the precision of the model. And I think that's actually part of the story here, is that the more we get people thinking about this, the more people are given the data. And it took us a year to get it, with extraordinary string pulling and so forth. But I'd like to see lots of statisticians get the data and come up with better models. And the more people you have, the better the precision might get, and be more likely to acknowledge these kinds of issues.
You mentioned burglary just now, which raises another point. You could measure the harm of a burglary by the value of what is stolen.
You could.
Yeah. And possibly that might be reflected in the sentence. But the point is that I want to raise...
Possibly.
The point I want to raise is that in the case of burglary, the distribution of value is going to have a very long tail.
Yes.
England So the shape of that distribution would have an effect on how you decided to incorporate it into an index, and possibly also the distribution of sentence length in cases of burglary may have a long tail.
Yes.
So how do you deal with the shape of the distribution?
From what I know about burglary sentences in this country, the distribution is driven not by the amount of cash value of what's taken, but by the severity of harm in what's called aggravated burglary, which in our Crown Court experiments was about half of all the burglaries where there was contact between the burglar and the victim.
So burglary plus some sort of violence.
This fellow smashed a pot over this guy's head and almost knocked him down three flights of stairs. Could have killed him. But it was still a burglary conviction. He wasn't charged with degree of bodily harm. That's typically not the case in this country.
But you know, you have cases, say, small time burglars gets into somebody's house when they're away and cleans it out, including all the metalwork, radiators, pipes, the lot.
Yes.
They've done enormous harm.
They have.
And if they were caught, that would no doubt be reflected somehow in the sentence.
I agree. That would be the case. Mm-hmm. Vast majority of burglaries of unoccupied homes would have range of value loss somewhere between £200 and £2,000. And I think the judges are pretty insensitive to that. But at the tail of the distribution, in the extreme cases you cite, I think that's right, with the value of the property. There's also the psychological damage of the property.
Yeah.
And the other victim at this conference was a doctor who was working on his PhD dissertation on medical statistics.
Mm-hmm.
He only had one copy, which is on a laptop, that this guy stole and sold. And he had listened for an hour to this guy talking about the years he had been gathering the data from all his patients. Of course, he had all the patients' data on the laptop as well. And then he talked about how bad he felt that he was too stupid to back it up. But then he never expected to lose his laptop out of his house.
Yeah.
And he always kept it in the house. Well, I think these are all good issues for how you sentence. But my basic argument, at least in the short run, is to stay away from sentence and to use this to drive police decisions to even refer the case to the prosecutor. Because the police have the ancient power of prosecution themselves, which has, again, two tests. Can you get a conviction? And if it's not in the public interest, even if you can, you shouldn't prosecute. As long as the police have reason to believe that by not taking the case of the prosecutor, they can get a better result in the public interest, they're allowed not to prosecute. It would be hard to do that with a murder. Easier to do it with a burglary, and we're actually going to not prosecute some burglars in this experiment.
I recall maybe a year, maybe 2 years ago, there was something in the press about the police force or home office deciding to no crime certain things. I forget the details now, but I do remember.
Well, no crime is a serious issue for all of this because it means that there is no recording of crime occurred.
Yeah.
Which is very different from we record a crime and then we decide not to prosecute for it.
Yeah, I mean, it must have got recorded at some point because somebody made the decision to do nothing about it. But there was a kind of policy
and
that certain things would be no crime.
The issue of when you decide to believe somebody and when then you decide that they're lying to you is a very sticky one. Moreover, sometimes the reporting officer thinks it's crime, records the details and the reviewer of it says what you've written down doesn't constitute a crime. For example, shouting at somebody, which is sometimes coded as an assault, doesn't fit the description of assault. And that happens all the time.
Yeah.
And the newspapers get a hold of it and they get the story going.
Yeah.
So I don't know which story.
As I recall, this went beyond that. I mean, it was actual crimes, which were no crime.
will. I think the various statistics watchdogs ought to put a stop to that.
Yeah. There was one little technical point. I can't remember whether it's before or after this slide. It's where you have, towards the end, about a dozen studies with various standardized means.
Oh, that was the meta-analysis.
This one, yes. Now, I noticed that you've actually used the standardized mean difference. In other words, you have divided the actual mean by the standard deviation of the population or the standard error of the estimate or what?
Yes, I couldn't tell you at this point.
Yeah, because I noticed looking at that, that whereas you've got a monotonic progression as you descend in the standardized
mean. By design.
Yeah, sure. If you actually look at the means, you see that this standardization has shuffled them around enormously. If you look at the...
Well, we arrange them...
Yeah, those are the standardized means, right, but pre-standardization is on the left.
Oh, these means, yes. It has indeed, yes.
And I was wondering, as it were, what is the technical reason for the standardization?
This. And the standardization is commonly used in meta-analysis to compare different baselines so that you would have a mean difference with a baseline of 20% that would be substantially different in size from a baseline of 60% or 70%.
So
all of these offenses had different baseline levels of frequency of convictions in the two-year follow-up period. And because those baselines vary so much, the standardization makes them equivalent with respect to how big the effect is.
Relative to the baseline?
Relative to the baseline,
okay,
which is
right.
Different
okay.
In the case, yes.
Yeah, because there is a... somewhat bewildering concept called effect size, which is mean divided by standard deviation.
It is bewildering. It's a problem, and I don't really have a better solution than this one.
Yeah. I mean, to my mind, it's a close approximation to meaningless.
Well, I don't think I'd go that far.
Well, I say close approximation.
That's actually why I prefer to do this as well as that.
Yeah.
Because every one of these is in effect adjusting for where the baseline is, but in a way that's much more comprehensible to a lawyer or a police chief. Even though the absolute values of these percentage differences vary widely. What you're not picking up is the influence of the variance of distributions, which is why most of the statisticians specializing in meta-analysis prefer that, and they think this is garbage.
It's a matter of trying to explain exactly what it means.
Exactly. The statisticians I know who specialize in meta-analysis are not particularly interested in explaining it to each other. But I wouldn't go anywhere without my bar graphs.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yes, sir. I wondered about your randomized control trials.
Yes.
So I come from medical stats background. It seems odd, not unreasonable, but that the decision to prosecute someone is essentially randomized. If someone, in the sense that has any, if you're a criminal or a suspected criminal coming along, and the police are kind of randomly deciding whether you get taken down that route or another route, do they have any right to challenge that? I suppose, I'm trying to get to try to understand the ethics behind this. In the drug development world, you would generally have two drugs or a drug and a placebo, and you don't know the drug will make any difference.
And you would also have patient consent.
Yes.
For participation,
So I just wondering
and
if you could...
The analogy doesn't work here because these aren't patients. They're not sick. They're not dealing with somebody whose obligation is to serve their best interests. They're dealing with the state whose obligation it is to protect the public. And under that rubric, the case law on this in the United States says that when the state has the power to decide what response will be made to people who broke the law, they need to know what works. And in a document called Experimentation of the Law, published in 1981 by the Federal Judicial Center, which is the research arm of the United States Supreme Court, the ethical argument was put as follows. If you're going to punish people without knowing the consequences of the punishment, whether you're going to increase the number of victims because you punish somebody and they commit more crimes, then you're under an ethical obligation to do a randomized controlled trial. It's unethical to inflict punishments without doing a randomized controlled trial, in just the same way that it's unethical to give people thalidomide without having done a proper randomized controlled trial on the consequences of thalidomide, which is what Britain did, but the U.S. refused to do, because it had a higher standard for using clinical trials in 1960 than Britain did. So the ethics of not doing the randomized trial are the counterfactual. And that's why the notion of equipoise is the central ethical principle in using clinical trials in both medicine and justice. If we don't know what is the better thing to do, then we're ethically obliged to answer the question with a randomized trial. If we do know, then we shouldn't use the randomized trial. So the standard of what we know then becomes all important. And if you think you know the answers because you're a judge and you've seen lots of cases before and you don't need any evidence, then you would say, I don't need to do that. Remarkably, the police are by far the most open-minded, and they're the ones who immediately say, we don't know the answer to that question. But in some cases, and I can tell you, two city councils in the United States, Milwaukee and Minneapolis, both agreed unanimously to approve my randomized trial of arresting people in their own home by random assignment algorithm to decide whether that was a good thing to do or not if they were beating their partner. And in one trial, it was a good thing. In another trial, it depended on whether they were employed or not. For unemployed people, arresting them doubled their repeat offending. For employed people, it cut it in half. And nobody liked that answer to the question. But it was still the best answer we could get that we never would have gotten if we hadn't done the randomized trial.
Yes.
So it's led to reconsideration of zero tolerance for domestic violence, with domestic violence victims' advocates now arguing against the mandatory arrest laws that are found in 28 of the 50 states in the United States. You wouldn't know it without a randomized trial. Where's the ethics? To do or not to do?
What is the reason? So if I have a trial, I go to my university committee. Is it the municipal authorities to get that kind of...
Well, if you have the elected representatives of all the councilmanic areas within the city of Milwaukee or the city of Minneapolis, you get as close as you can get for an ethical purpose. It's generally the ethical duty of these councils to decide what services to provide, how to regulate the police department, and so on. And if they say we want the information from a randomized trial and we'll be finding out that way, I think you've got a more representative body than a committee of ethicists who are appointed at a university. The crucial thing that the universities still differ on in the U.S. is that some of them think that they're doing the arresting. And I've pointed out to them that universities don't arrest people. They might give people drugs in a university hospital, and that's a very high standard of care because then the university is responsible for administering the treatment. But when criminologists are simply providing a website in which you enter the cases and a random assignment comes out on a case-by-case basis, but that's being done by a practitioner who's then using the authority of the state to either arrest or not, to prosecute or not, and that's how we're doing it. It's manifestly not the University of Cambridge that is prosecuting people. It is the police departments and prosecutors in question. And to be fair, I think the U.S. has more intensive ethical oversight. There is no ethical oversight right now of police decision-making. There is for prisons, but not for police prosecution. And so what we've done is to go to this criminal justice board in the police area, so the prosecutor, the defense lawyers, the prison service, the probation service, the police, they all sign up and agree to this. So that's kind of like an ethics review committee at the university. And believe me, they don't agree on much.
I think the other thing that they would do is periodic review of a medical trial to make sure that if one arm was drastically better than the other, you don't keep going on the
safety
trial.
Committees, yeah.
So you need somebody to do that, because otherwise there's no equal protection. If you quickly find out that one's better than the other, but no one's reviewing it until the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm absolutely dedicated to this, and we weren't required to have a safety committee in Philadelphia. Safety committees are a British idea. I think more than the IRB rules don't apply to non-medical trials in the U.S. But what we have done in Philadelphia with the trials we've done there is to have monthly review of the impact data. And we came close to stopping the high harm trial in Philadelphia probation, and then the data reversed. It crossed back into no difference, which is where we are at the moment. But I mean, we haven't even gotten 6 months follow up on all the randomly signed cases yet. So I think the bias should be to run it out. You know, when they stopped the aspirin trial early, they left us with a clear reduction in heart attacks and a statistically non-significant increase in strokes. Thanks a lot. I would have, if I'd been in that trial, I would have said, look, ask for volunteers to keep going and let's see whether that increase in strokes from taking aspirin is going to be statistically significant in the long run. So it's an unanswered question. So I think, again, the ethics are not clear about whether you should stop a trial early to save lives. And as for saving lives from having fewer heart attacks, now we get into the harm issue. Because, yes, I might die if I have a heart attack, but if I have a stroke, I might be crippled and unable to talk for the next 20 years, which is worse. You won't get that out of a sentencing guideline. But I think you could look at some research on it to at least to inform that decision as to whether to continue the study.
When you're dealing with this randomized allocation of the two approaches to, say, prosecution, question number one, is that going to be publicly known that you're doing that?
Well, certainly in the U.S. when we had the City Council approval, it was on public record.
Okay.
And it's in the minutes of the Criminal Justice Court. We don't put out a press release saying, hey, everybody, we're going to use a lottery to decide who to arrest.
But I dare say it'll get around. Because,
Might, but I don't think it has.
I know Jimmy who did this, and he didn't get prosecuted, and Bobby who did exactly the same thing he did.
That's already happening.
Yeah, sure, I know it's already
happening. They can't tell the difference between chaos and random assignment.
one suspects that it could get out that this is what was going on.
It will sometimes.
Yeah. And in that case, is there scope for the criminals to play that system?
I don't see how you play random assignment. You could file an appeal based on it or defense, but basically, I think the question of statistical significance here in the smallest sense is SUTPA, the stable unit transfer value, which requires independence of each case from the other. So if the guy who doesn't get arrested tells the guy who does, if the guy who gets out of prison tells the guy who's still in prison, that could affect the attitude of the person who's being punished, and now the treatments are no longer independent. So that's the big worry about this stuff getting
around. Yeah, you've just actually formulated what I was groping for there.
So the SUTPA thing is a bigger danger in small towns than in big cities. So where we're doing this deferred prosecution on a random assignment basis, the population is 3 million. And I like to think that there's some more anonymity there. It's going to be less of an issue. Good. Well, you're also polite. I'll talk you to sleep tonight if you don't stop me.
Right, well, perhaps this is an opportune moment. And just one final point. Cambridge University used to arrest people.
Ah, yes, but those were students.
No,
prostitutes. Yes,
prostitutes. Yes,
the prostitutes,
yes,
who were corrupting the students.
Yeah, and they could, they had a place where they could lock them up.
Arguably, in the modern sense, the Bulldogs were officers of the Crown in an indirect way, and so it was just a form of police.
Right. Anyway, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Thank you all for coming.
Appreciate it.
If anyone would like to subscribe for this year.